شيل شيل عالجمة لي شيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهليل يا ليلو.
Resistance isn't a metaphor. It's a lived reality. Welcome to This Week in Palestine, the broadcast that acts as a lifeline between the rubble of Gaza and the heart of the global conscience. We don't use euphemisms here. We don't trim the truth to fit the margins of empire. Instead, we center Palestinian humanity. We follow the thread of liberation from Jenin to the world, proving that even under the heaviest occupation, hope remains unshaken. I'm Yara Rashid, and this is This Week in Palestine.
ويل ويل عالظالمي ويل ويل من الله لا سهر على نجوم الليل أنا داويل.
Before we begin, I must share that the views expressed during this hour belong to our hosts and guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. You're here because you know this is not a space for polite avoidance. You're here because you're tired of sanitized sound bites. You're here for the truth. Welcome back to This Week in Palestine. It is Sunday, December 21st. Today, we sit with the reality of Gaza and the West Bank. We sit with the families whose homes are ruins and whose voices struggle to rise above a world that has, too often, turned its back. We have to be honest today. Peace has been a mask for erasure, a mask for a policy of bulldozers and bombs. We watch the headlines fade, but we refuse to let the truth fade with them. We ask the hard questions. When does conscience win? When does action replace apathy? How long must a people suffer before the world decides to care? Don't turn away. Stay with us as we uplift Palestinian resilience and carry forward the flame of justice. This journey is shared, it is urgent, and it is sacred.
شيل شيل عالجمالي شيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهليل يا ليلو.
Today we bring you a critical Minds of Minds, a deep dive debate that refuses to look away from the shifting tectonic plates of global power. Joining us for this analysis are two of the most incisive voices in the struggle for Palestinian liberation, Norman Finkelstein and Mu'in Rabbani. In a new discussion titled Palestine, Geopolitics and the Far Right, hosted by the India and Global Left Channel, these two scholars dissect the wreckage of recent ceasefire efforts and the unsettling new political landscape of 2025. They move beyond the headlines to ask, is the world truly reckoning with Gaza, or is it merely repackaging colonial rule under a new name? To understand the weight of this conversation, one must understand the decades of forensic and strategic labor these two men bring to the table. Finkelstein is a world-renowned political scientist and forensic scholar who received his doctorate from Princeton University. The son of Holocaust survivors, he has dedicated his life to exposing the misuse of history and international law. He is best known for The Holocaust Industry and his comprehensive 2018 study, Gaza, an Inquest into its Martyrdom. Finkelstein is known for his uncompromising, evidence-based approach. He often challenges not only the Israeli state, but also what he views as the failures of the international legal system to protect Palestinian life. Rabbani is a Dutch-Palestinian analyst and researcher who specializes in the Arab-Israeli conflict. With an academic background from Tufts and Georgetown, he has occupied high-level strategic roles, including serving as a senior analyst for the International Crisis Group. He is a co-editor of Jadalia and a frequent contributor to the Journal of Palestine Studies and The Nation. Rabbani provides a sharp strategic lens on regional geopolitics. He is an expert on the architecture of occupation, specifically the legacies of the Oslo Accords and the internal dynamics of Palestinian political movements. Why this debate matters now? The discussion is particularly urgent as it addresses the Trump plan dynamics of 2025 and the confusing rise of far-right figures in the West who have begun to use Palestine as a rhetorical tool. Finkelstein and Rabbani provide the necessary clarity to distinguish between genuine solidarity and cynical political maneuvering.
Mine, if we could start with you, we've been discussing Palestine and Israel since at least even before the beginning of the genocide, but it hasn't gotten enough attention since the so-called ceasefire plan of October 10. So if you could help us give us a correct framework to look at the period in the aftermath of October 10, that would be helpful for our viewers.
Well, on October 8th, I believe was the date, Israel and the Palestinians signed an agreement in Egyptian resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh, basically dealing with the immediate issues, the first phase of the Trump-Netanyahu initiative that had been unveiled on the 29th of September, and it dealt with an exchange of captives, a surge in the delivery of humanitarian goods and supplies, a partial withdrawal of Israeli forces from within the Gaza Strip, and, you know, various other immediate, and of course, a cessation of hostilities. And what, in terms of the situation on the ground, what has essentially happened is that according to the Americans, the Palestinians, and specifically Hamas, has scrupulously fulfilled each and every one of their obligations to an extent that surprised the Americans. So they immediately released all the living captives. They searched for, found, and delivered all but one of the dead captives. They have fully ceased hostilities and so on, and they have not tried to infiltrate into the Israeli-occupied zone of the Gaza Strip, while the Israelis, from the very outset, have systematically violated each and every one of their commitments. They released less captives than they agreed to, not from the categories that were agreed to. Some who were supposed to be released to their homes in the West Bank were deported. Israel committed to permitting the entry of at least 600 trucks a day into the Gaza Strip. They have permitted at most 200 a day to enter. And now we just had Storm Byron, fierce rain storms and winter inclement conditions in the Gaza Strip. Newborn infants are freezing to death due to hypothermia because, according to Jan Egeland of the Norwegian Refugee Council, there are tens of thousands of weatherproof tents sitting on the borders of the Gaza Strip awaiting Israeli permission to enter the Gaza Strip, but are not receiving that permission. And of course, Israel is continuing on a daily basis with the bombing of the Gaza Strip, including the zone from which it has withdrawn. It's killed upwards of 400 Palestinians. It has now resumed assassinations of high-profile Hamas leaders. It is continuing with the systematic destruction of structures in the Gaza Strip. So Israel is essentially trying to empty the agreement of all substance, to transform it into one where the Palestinians are obliged to scrupulously adhere to their commitments, and Israel can pretend it never agreed to anything. So the genocide essentially continues, albeit on a lower and less visible scale. All the discussions now are about the second phase of the agreement, which deals with the formation of this neo-colonial authority, the Board of Peace, also initially known as the Blair Witch Project, which under the leadership of Trump and Blair is supposed to be responsible for the administration of the Gaza Strip, with its international stabilization force acting under its authority. The problem here is that the Trump-Netanyahu initiative lacks any political horizon whatsoever. In fact, it's designed not to have a political horizon. It's what Carol Kasabari of the Carter Center has called Oslo with helmets. And because of this, the states and governments, particularly Arab and Muslim states, that are being called upon to fund this entire exercise, to supply the troops for it, have thus far refused to contribute on the grounds that they need credible, irreversible political momentum towards a Palestinian state in order to contribute, including guarantees that Israel will not resume the war with American blessing at the time of its choosing. So we're heading towards a situation where the temporary becomes indefinite and eventually permanent, which is something that the Palestinians, of course, are opposed to, something the regional powers are not comfortable with, something Washington does not like, but something that Israel is perfectly comfortable with because it can indefinitely extend the current situation, which is inflicting misery upon misery upon the Palestinian inhabitants of the Gaza Strip in the hope that they will start to leave in increasing numbers, essentially being forced out by circumstance, or what Israelis like to refer to as voluntary transfer.
Professor Finkelstein, your comments, particularly on what is a correct framework to analyze the post-ceasefire phase of the Israel-Palestine conflict?
Well, nothing I'm going to say can be called Monday morning quarterbacking, because I said it at the time I had conversations with Muin about it, and I said at the time, and I say again right now, the essence of what was agreed to was a restoration of the status quo ante October 7th, 2023, a return to what it was, with the one big caveat, not a trivial caveat, the one big caveat that Gaza is no more. So people are immured in the concentration camp, but a concentration camp devoid of the most basic life-sustaining materials, namely shelter and food. There was no doubt in my mind that Israel would never admit sufficient humanitarian aid. It was clear that it was going to be a restoration of the status quo ante, but again, with the crucial caveat, all the agricultural land, which is actually the main agricultural land, is in the green zone, but even the agricultural land in the green zone has been destroyed for at least a significant period of time, whether forever, I can't say. That's not my area of specialty. But it was already non-arable because of the Israeli bombing. So there's no basis now for domestic production of food. Israel will turn the screws on humanitarian aid. It's made clear it won't cooperate with UNRWA, which has the International Court of Justice, the main legal body of the UN. It determined in November 17th, 2024, in its advisory opinion, it said that UNRWA was the only humanitarian organization capable of supplying with technical competence and at scale the necessary humanitarian aid that Gaza needs at this point. I read now they're talking about all of these other organizations replacing UNRWA. It's never going to happen. American organizations, I should say. And also American organizations bidding for reconstruction. It's never going to happen. There's not going to be any reconstruction in Gaza until the population is emptied out. Now, Netanyahu at some point talked about thinning out the population. So it's possible they thin it out to say 300,000 people. Maybe there'll be some reconstruction. And so I believe it's a restoration of the status quo ante. The Israeli government was hoping for a stampede during those two years plus of their genocide in Gaza. The stampede never happened. So now they're going to have to settle for a trickle. Palestinians by hook or by crook, Gaza Palestinians by hook or by crook, figuring out how to leave. And the only other point I would make is I never believed the ceasefire had anything to do with Gaza. Some people say it was because Trump was angling for the Nobel Prize. That's probably in the back of his head. And frankly, I have very little interest in what's in the back of the sides or the front of his head, since de facto it's empty. But the real purpose, I said at the time, I even said in the Piers Morgan program, when he was trying to drum up enthusiasm for this Trump ceasefire, he said, so what do you think is the purpose? I said, well, the purpose is obvious. Trump is a real estate mogul. He's 78 years old. You don't teach an old dog new tricks, and the leopard doesn't change its spots. He's looking for the money from investments in the Gulf. But the problem for Saudi Arabia was it couldn't join the Abraham Accords while the genocide was going on in real time on the computer screen. So he needed a fig leaf, and the fig leaf was to pretend there's a ceasefire, and then it gets off the front page of the news. If you look at the newspapers the last few days, for example, the lead stories are about Rob Reiner and his wife being killed. The second story is about the killings in Australia. And there's nothing on the front page anymore about Gaza. And once this so-called ceasefire was put in effect, what was the first thing to happen? Right after it was put in effect, the first thing that happened is the Saudi leader, MBS, he went to the White House and he got a royal welcome. And that was the main purpose, to provide MBE, the Saudi, what is his official title now? Is he still a crown prince? The Saudi crown prince has a fig leaf to go to the White House and then to lay the foundations for what Trump all along has been calling the deal of the century.
Muin, do you have any comments?
I generally agree with Norm, but I would add one caveat, which is that I don't think the Trump initiative in and of itself is going to be sufficient for Saudi Arabia to normalize relations with Israel. Saudi leadership has repeatedly stated that for it to normalize relations with Israel in the context of the Gaza genocide, it would need credible, irreversible, and time-bound progress towards an independent Palestinian state. And I don't think that should be dismissed out of hand as a fig leaf to cover their real intentions, because Saudi Arabia has a large politically engaged population, and even in autocracies, public opinion matters. And I think that the Saudi leadership, including MBS, has reached the conclusion that they can not afford to normalize relations with Israel just because a ceasefire agreement has been reached. What I would add is that the agreement made it possible for the Saudis to start striking deals again left and right with the United States. And what's interesting here is that the U.S. is now pursuing relations with Saudi Arabia almost independently of relations with Israel. So Trump administration announced its intention to sell F-35s to Israel. Israel put out a statement as if, you know, Israel already has them, of course. Sorry, I meant Saudi. The Israelis, taking the prerogative of speaking on behalf of the U.S. administration, indicated that the U.S. would not be selling these weapons to Saudi Arabia unless Saudi Arabia first normalized relations with Israel, to which Trump then said, no, we're going to sell them, and we're going to sell them our top-of-the-line models. In other words, if the Saudis, unlike the Israelis, pay for them, they can have them. And so we're getting this interesting dynamic where access of key Arab client states like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the UAE to strategic American goods, whether weaponry or, you know, computer chips and so on, are no longer directly tied to their acquiescence to Israel in the way that it has been in the past. But I do fully agree with Norm that the priority for the Americans is to continue consummating these Arab-Israeli normalization agreements. A question becomes that are the Americans willing to turn the screws on Israel to do what's necessary to make this possible? There's very little indication that they're going to be prepared to do so anytime soon.
I agree that, I don't say I agree. I think that Nguyen's probably right that that there may be more conditions by Saudi Arabia before it goes through fully with normalization. I was speaking more as to what Trump's motivation was rather than whether or not what he envisaged will actually come to be. I would just want to stress one point, which I guess I sort of disagree with Nguyen on, not strongly, but it was the most remarkable capitulation by the Arab Muslim states, what they did on November 17th with the Security Council resolution. There's really nothing in the annals of that very sorry chapter that even came close to what they did November 17th with the Security Council resolution. The UN Security Council resolution completely capitulated to Israel on all points. Almost certainly they wrote the text with minor tiny tweaks. They almost certainly wrote the text of the Security Council resolution. The text annulled 70 years of UN history. When I say 70 years of UN history, I'm referring not just to the Security Council, not just to the General Assembly, not just various organs, the Third Committee, the Sixth Committee of the UN, not just the International Court of Justice, every division, every subdivision of the UN, the record that was accumulated, and really that record could probably fill a medium-sized library, the amount of material that went into the creation of a near unanimous consensus inside all of the UN organs over a 70-year period. That whole record, it was annulled. It vanished. It evaporated. There was, for those of you those of the listeners who look at UN resolutions, when a particular topic has a long history, usually a UN resolution begins literally with between 5 and 7 pages, single-spaced, of rehearsing the record. We reiterate this.
Preambles.
Preambles. We reiterate this. We emphasize that. We strongly recall this. We recall that. 6 or 7 pages. This UN resolution had no preamble. It abolished the whole record. And it was so brazen. It was so brazen in its defiance of the International Court of Justice. The International Court of Justice ruled in July 2025 that the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza, was illegal, and it had to end as rapidly as possible. That was what it ruled. Well, that was all gone. It disappeared in the resolution. There is only talk of If the Palestinian Authority reforms, although there's no delineation of what it has to do to reform, it just says, if the Palestinian Authority reforms, then it says that may, M-A-Y, open a pathway, P-A-T-H-W-A-Y, to a permanent solution. But for there to be the permanent solution, there has to be agreement between Israel and the Palestinian Authority on what the terms of that permanent solution would be. Well, it doesn't take Shakespeare to figure out that if you add all that up, it's nothing. All the talk about the occupation being illegal, by the way, you know what else disappeared from the resolution?
Occupation.
It's no occupation. Completely vanished. Gaza, if you read that resolution, you couldn't have a clue from a legal point of view. What is Gaza? Is Gaza a part of the West Bank? You wouldn't know that from the resolution. Is Gaza occupied territory? You wouldn't know that from the resolution. It's nowhere there. Gaza is what they used to say during the era of European colonialism. They described Africa as res nullius, which is literally means a thing of nobody. It's just suspended in thin air. And that's what Gaza became, the resolution. So what
first
happened?
First come, first served.
Exactly. Exactly. Because it belongs to nobody. So first come, first serve. So why did the resolution pass? It passed because all the Muslim and Arab states supported it. If I were to tell you the list, I can't even remember in my mind. Egypt supported it. Jordan supported it. Pakistan supported it. Indonesia supported it. Saudi Arabia supported it. The Turkey supported it. Qatar supported it. And the most egregious, maybe not egregious is the right word, but the Palestinians' most stalwart supporter among the Arab states, outside the so-called resistance front, was Algeria. Here's how Algeria spoke to the resolution after it was passed. At the outset, said Mr. Benjama from Algeria, allow me to express our appreciation to the United States for presenting the resolution we just adopted, aimed at implementing the comprehensive plan endorsed by all parties. We acknowledge the efforts undertaken by President Trump in advancing peace worldwide.
Sounds like Gianni Infantino, the head of FIFA.
I mean, the level of self-abasement, of groveling, of sycophancy, it's really kind of mind-boggling to read what happened. And that was not a trivial fact, because the Russians and the Chinese did have veto power, and they made it very clear they were not happy with the resolution. The Russians called it a black day in the history of the United Nations. And they ended their statement by saying, don't say we didn't warn you. They knew this was going to be a disaster. Don't say we didn't warn you. But they and the Chinese said the same thing. We wanted to veto the resolution, but then all of the Arab states, Muslim states, including the Palestinian Authority, lined up with the United States. So they said it was just politically untenable for them to veto it. So it was the Arab and Muslim states which enabled it. And I want to just say one last thing, and then Muin goes. You know what was the most shocking thing about the resolution? I mean, it was filled with shocking things. I was walking the streets literally for 2 weeks. And even today, I find myself cursing at the folks who voted for that resolution. Because in a way, in a very trivial matter, it kind of hammered the nail of into the coffin of everything I had been working on for the last 30 years. All I did was go through the UN resolutions, the ICJ opinions, trying to accumulate a impregnable record of support for the international consensus, which was being defiantly opposed by the U.S. and Israel. Well, all of that was annulled on November 17th. That record is dead. And just the last point, what I said, the most amazing thing about the resolution literally, it gave Gaza to Donald J. Trump personally. It gave him the deed to Gaza. The presiding body in Gaza is now called the Board of Peace. The Board of Peace has no internal mechanism to hold Trump, who was named the head and director of the Board of Peace. There is no internal mechanism to hold him accountable to anyone. None. The Board of Peace, its modalities, who will be on it, how it will be operated, nothing in the resolution. It just names Donald Trump, because the resolution validated the so-called Trump peace plan, which named him the head of the Board of Peace. And if there were any doubt on that matter, after the vote was taken, the U.S. rep at the UN stated, Donald Trump is the head of the Board of Peace. And the Board of Peace is not accountable to any external organ, none. The only thing that Trump is held accountable to, the resolution requested, it didn't say mandatory, it just requested that every 6 months, the Board of Peace should send the Security Council a progress report. That's it. There has not been anything like that since King Leopold II was given the Congo at the 1884 Berlin Conference. There's never been anything like it. He was given Gaza. It's not that breathtaking.
So everything Norm has just said is entirely correct and accurate. I would also add several other points. I mean, there's two antecedents for this. The first is that the initial iteration of the Trump initiative was drafted on the basis of negotiations between Washington and a number of Arab and Muslim states who had met with Trump on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly in the fall and basically told him, you know, this whole thing is getting out of hand. We need to bring it to an end. They formulated a 21-point plan. And then Netanyahu parachutes into Washington, changes it, manages to introduce key changes to these 21 points, reduce them to 20 points, even manages to delete a clause in which Israel commits to not repeating its bombing of Qatar. The Arab and Muslim leaders express their frustration, their outrage, but do absolutely nothing to insist that Washington revert to the version of the agreement that they negotiated and accept the revised agreement. So that was really the first capitulation. The second is before the UN Security Council passed its Gaza resolution, it passed a very similar resolution on the Western Sahara, in which it basically tried to annul International Court of Justice rulings on the right of the Sahrawis to self-determination and so on, and endorsed the idea of the Western Sahara becoming an autonomous province, essentially, under Moroccan sovereignty. So that was another important precedent. Hamas had come under enormous pressure from these Arab and Muslim leaders, including of key mediators, Egypt, Turkey, and Qatar, to accept the revised Trump-Netanyahu initiative. And then the Palestinian Authority, despite being completely marginalized and excluded from this initiative, came under enormous pressure from particularly the Gulf states to endorse the Security Council resolution. And once it did so, it became impossible for Algeria, as a representative of the Arab group on the Security Council, not to accept it. And I think if you read the rest of the Algerian ambassador's remarks, in addition to the sycophancy, he also expresses some serious misgivings about this resolution, if I recall correctly. But he basically said the Palestinian leadership accepted it, all the Arab states accepted it, my hands are tied. The Russians and the Chinese, sorry?
But you can correct me. I think he was the one that used the expression. He said, to quote the English expression, you can't be more pious than the Pope.
Yeah, I believe that's the case. The Russians, very clear, and the Chinese, they have bigger fish to fry with Washington than Gaza. You know, the Russians did not want to jeopardize negotiations over Ukraine on behalf of a Gaza resolution. The Chinese did not want to jeopardize trade negotiations with Washington over Gaza. So the resolution passed exactly in the manner that Norm describes. Having said that, in 1993, we had something very similar. We had a document known as the Oslo Agreement that basically transformed the West Bank and Gaza Strip from occupied territory to disputed territory, which also sought to completely, although in a much less brazen and obscene way, to completely annul the international consensus and international law and all the rest of it. And the Clinton administration, acting through UN Ambassador Madeleine Albright, basically told the Security Council it should cease all dealings with the question of Palestine. And that failed. And it ended up with the International Court of Justice last year declaring that the occupation is illegal. After the Security Council resolution passed, the General Assembly passed one resolution reaffirming the inalienable right of the Palestinian people to self-determination, sovereignty, and statehood. And just this week, with a very, very large majority, passed a resolution endorsing the ICJ's more recent advisory opinion on UNRWA and international organizations and their right of immunity and access in the occupied territory. So what I'm trying to say is we're now dealing with two competing visions of international law, of international institutions, of political struggle. And it's by no means a foregone conclusion which is going to emerge on top and which is going to be defeated. But we all have a role to play, I think, in ensuring that the Trump initiative ends in the same dustbin of history in which Oslo ended. But having said that, we also need to remember the dustbin of history is littered with just causes. So there is absolutely no room here for complacency either.
I'm going to just qualify or disagree the general picture we both agree on. I mean, if Wayne and I were debating destiny again, I suspect we'd be on the same side.
I wouldn't be in the room. Once was enough.
Just a couple of points. First of all, I did not find the Russian statement cynical. Now, I'm quite aware that Putin is a ruthless thug. I'm aware of that. But I would also say, Muin, so was Stalin. But I thought that Gromyko's statement in 1947 in the UN General Assembly was authentic. Obviously, they had a goal. They wanted to get rid of British imperialism from the Middle East, and they thought that if they eject the British, you know, it would be a good thing. So they voted for...
Can I just interrupt you, Norm? Just apologies. But the difference here is that Gromyko's vote in 47 reflected his statement, whereas... the Russian vote more recently contradicted the statement.
I didn't feel it contradicted it because I thought there were two difficulties faced by everyone. Now, granted, even to the Arab and Muslim states, I will grant it. Difficulty number one was Trump blackmailed them He said, if you don't sign on to this resolution, we're going to give Israel a free hand to escalate its genocide in Gaza. Just like he's blackmailing them now. Again, he's saying, if you don't supply forces to the International Stabilization Force, then we're not going to tell Israel to withdraw. So he's doing the same sort of blackmail. So that was a legitimate consideration. I get that. I'm not going to deny facts. It was a legitimate consideration that Trump was blackmailing them with the threat, you don't sign on to this resolution, we're giving Israel the green light to escalate the genocide. Number two, the Russians faced the problem of being more biased than the Pope. They said that Trump lined up, you know, it was not just the members of the Security Council who came from the Arab Muslim world. He lined up everybody in order to get the vote. And the Russians said they strong-armed them in their countries and they strong-armed them in the UN in New York. The Russians are very straightforward. I thought if it were just a matter of realpolitik, some people said it was a quid pro quo, we'll give you on Gaza if you give us on Ukraine. You know, that was the speculation. I don't think they had to use the language they did. A black day in the history of the United Nations. Don't say we didn't warn you. I felt, like with Gromyko's speech, there was authenticity there. Whether authenticity makes any difference, I don't know. But that was came away with.
Yeah.
And that brings my second point. Yes, it's true. There was a lot of blackmail going on. But the Arab Muslim states had the option to do what the Russians and Chinese did, which is to say what's going on here is disgusting.
Yeah, no, that's perfectly true.
To heap praise on Trump?
You're entirely correct. Yeah. But my point is, yeah, first of all, you know, it's become part of 21st century diplomacy that you have to appease and suck up to the moron in the White House. That's certainly true. But what I'm saying specifically about the Russians, I'm not doubting the authenticity of their statement. Rather, I'm saying I don't think that their reason for not vetoing is exclusively tied to Palestinian and Arab endorsement of the resolution. I think in the Kremlin, they also calculated that if they would have sabotaged Trump's pet project, that it would have been much more difficult for them to then seek to strike a deal on Ukraine.
I have no problem with that. Mm-hmm. I have no problem with that. As I said, even in 1947, the British were supporting the Zionists because they wanted to eject the British from
the Russians were, the Soviets were, you mean?
Excuse me, the Soviets, excuse me. I get that, but I still say, and you'll forgive me for repeating myself, there were five countries, the US, the UK, France, Greece, and I forgot the fifth, who attacked Hamas forcefully during the UN Security Council debate on the resolution. Do you know that except for one sentence by Algeria, there was not one word of what Israel did in Gaza after October 7th? Not one word. You didn't have to do that. You didn't have to be silent.
It's true. Fully agree.
No, it was such a display of servility, of cravenness. It was revolting. Really, it just filled me. I can't tell you how my innards writhed each time.
It was kissing the ring and telling the emperor how beautiful his clothes are.
It's, you know, it's Kim Il-sung writ large across the whole world. Nobody having, it's like Trump's cabinet has become the world.
Well, Kim Il-sung, I think, is formally still the president of DPRK. So, you know, I think the analogy may well prove very prescient given, you know, the nature of U.S. politics these days. But I think the broader point is taking everything you say into consideration, it's also important to point out that nothing is written in stone. And there was, as you well remember, an equal level of disgust and revulsion and fatalism and all the rest of it in September 93 on account of the Oslo Accords.
Yeah, but I think you missed one point, Muin. For a long time, Oslo was the only game in town.
Yes, yes. And unfortunately, this will be the framework within which this issue will be addressed for the foreseeable future. I think its initial period is till 2027. I do have the feeling, for a variety of reasons, that history is going to move much faster in this case. But yes, you're entirely right. Oslo didn't disappear overnight, and this isn't going to either. But I'm just pointing out that we are not, you know, dealing with something that is set in stone.
You recognize, Muin, that the foreseeable future is what remains of my life. So, you know the famous quip by John Maynard Keynes. There was an economics conference, and everyone was saying, in the long run, in the long run, in the long run. And then Keynes cut the conversation short by saying, quote, in the long run, we're dead.
Well, even in the short term, this is all going to, of course, come first and foremost at the expense of the Palestinian population of the Gaza Strip, who is now once again being abandoned by those who demanded the acceptance of this accord, of this agreement, of this resolution, on the grounds that it was the best way to prevent the catastrophe that they're now experiencing.
Its purpose is very straightforward: to get Gaza off the front page.
Yeah.
Succeeded. Yeah, it's gone now. It's been replaced by Rob Reiner. The spat between what's her name, Erica and Kirk. Candace, Erica Kirk and Candace Owens. These are the These are now the burning issues of our time.
Well, today they are.
I wonder if we may, I know this isn't part of your agenda, and we only have 10 minutes left, but I would like to articulate a thought that's troubling me, and it's related, but it's not directly related, but maybe it could be a kickoff to a future conversation. And this is my concern. Well, neither Muin Rabbani, nor Norman Finkelstein, nor several others, they're no longer the main or the most prominent spokespersons for the Palestinian and the Gazan, their rights under natural law or international law. It's a wholly new ball game, and the new ball game is: the main spokespersons have now become the ultra-right in the U.S. So when people think about critics of Israel and critics of Jews, they don't think about myself, they don't think about Muin, they now think of Tucker Carlson, they now think of Nick Fuentes.
Is this why Muin is going to meet Nick Fuentes and Tucker Carlson tonight?
And they now think of Candace Owens. And I have to say, I find this an extremely troubling development, that they're harnessing to a far right wing agenda criticism of Israel, harsh criticism, which is totally warranted, exposing Israel's crimes. For example, Tucker Carlson's recent trip to Qatar, I guess it was Qatar or
yes.
Dubai? Yeah, to Qatar, in which he showed, you know, images of what's been done to those children. Mm-hmm. It's now the criticism, and also, and not trivially, the machinations, the ruthless machinations of the Jewish supremacist billionaire class. It's no longer connected with myself or Muin. It's now become a far-right cause. And I think a real danger lurks there of what they may do with that cause of Israel and American Jews. And I have to say, I do think it's important to carve out a, I don't know how comfortable Muin feels with this term, but a left-wing account of what's going on. Now, there's going to be intersection. As I said, somebody wrote me and said, you know, Tucker Carlson, this was the first day, Tucker Carlson's podcast of his visit to Qatar, the first night he said it got 20 million views. And I wrote back, well, I'm very happy about that. I'm very happy about that. So there's going to be, at some level, an intersection between what they're saying and what we're saying. And I'm not going to criticize the existence of that intersection. But I do believe there's a real problem here. Because I do think, I'm not going to name names, but I do think a lot of them just don't like Jews. And that's a problem. Or let me give Muin the last word, because we're running out of time. So I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
No, I think you raise perfectly legitimate points. And I think it's the shame of the leftist gatekeepers, well, left, you know, the Democratic Party establishment, that this has now, that you are seeing people on the right take much more principled positions on this issue than, you know, the Democratic establishment ever has or ever will. I think you're now also beginning to see real movement on the left. I mean, if you look, for example, at the Mamdani campaign in New York City, if you look at you know, the younger generation, college students, even the Democratic Party base, you know, Israel has irreversibly lost the left, the center, and is increasingly losing on the right. Now, it's losing in each of these constituencies for different reasons. And I completely, you know, share your concerns about some of the things that are happening on the right and on the extreme right, that much of which is beyond the pill. But having said that, when you're faced with such an emergency, with such a crisis, coalitions become necessary. You know, the Vietnam War wasn't ended solely by college students. It was also business leaders turning against government policy and so on. And so I think we need to find ways to, as you suggested, you know, to seek those intersections and strengthen those intersections without in any way compromising on our principles and on our values, particularly that we are engaged in the struggle because we believe in, you know, the fundamental value of human equality rather than the superiority of one group over another.
I'll just leave it at one of the problems is this, if I can use the term, this hijacking of this cause by the far right. Why it's proven to be so troubling is if you take, let's say, the top 10 or 15 podcasters, they're all the far right. The left has no place there. If you take the top people, Candace Owens, Nick Fuentes, Tucker Carlson, I'll leave aside for the moment Joe Rogan, which is a more a grayer area. But if you take the top people, Andrew Tate, you know, go on down the line, they'll get 1 to 2 million views a day. The left, at most, will get 150,000. The top person.
They're that means the left has work to do.
Yes. So part of it is by default that this has happened because the left has no place in podcasting. It's, as I said, it falls in the range of, at most, 150,000. And they fall in the range of 1 to 2 or 3 million. So it's partly a default effect. There's no left in the podcasting universe, a substantial left in the podcasting universe. But the other thing is, I don't think there's a there has been an attempt to clearly delineate what distinguishes us between our support of Palestinian rights and their support of Palestinian rights. Where is the dividing line?
And
I was on with one of those persons, mm-hmm. and before I know it, I'm hearing that all the survivors of Nazi Holocaust were actually Bolsheviks who had killed millions of Christians, and now
60 million,
and we're now pretending to be Holocaust survivors. Well, hey, that's not where I'm coming from.
Look, I mean, you know, the differences, I think, are clear. Those on the right are opposing Israeli policy because they think it's bad for the U.S., bad for the U.S.'s position in the world, and bad for U.S. interests in the Middle East, whereas those on the left oppose it because they think it's fundamentally morally wrong and bad for humanity. That's at least one distinction that I can think of.
I would say, Muin,
Are there also those on the right who are motivated by fundamental human decency? Of course there are.
I think it's different. I think fundamental human indecency. Like Fuentes keeps reiterating that he thought Hitler was really cool, then...
No, of course. You have those types of, as well. You know, you have people who are drawn to this issue by hatred of Jews, you people who are drawn to this issue by hatred of Muslims because they see this as somehow increasing Muslim immigration or whatever. And then you have people who are drawn to this issue by hatred of both.
Yeah, but the problem is they used to be, you were part of the Palestine Solidarity Movement. For a long time. You recognize that the haters were pretty marginal. They were there.
Yeah.
But they weren't the heart of the movement.
No.
But now, as I said, the problem is they've become the main exponents of the movement.
I wouldn't say that. I would say that there are certain individuals who had a very large pre-existing audience before they became engaged in this issue. But I would not characterize them as being the core of the movement.
With sufficient clarity. I was trying to say they've become the public face of the movement.
Yeah, to a certain extent, that is certainly true.
You consider that a problem?
I consider that a failure of the left, and the left has work to do and questions to answer. And I would rather not, you know, begrudge Tucker Carlson his audience than ask questions of others of why is yours so much smaller? You know, what are you doing wrong? Why can't you be as effective? Why can't you reflect the values of your own constituency, the way those on the right seem to be doing successfully for their part?
I guess we must place the context of larger reality that we are overall living in an age of right-wing populism. I mean, the left is there. And so the right-wing type narratives of simplistic binaries drawn along ethnic lines, or in fact, sometimes going beyond the Israel-Palestine conflict, some of these conversations around capitalism, for instance, in opposition, for instance, to Big Pharma, has become extremely popular in the U.S., cutting across ideological lines. That doesn't mean the right-wing narrative is comprehensive, because they reduce that question to very simplistic narratives about what Big Pharma is. But when you try to look at the larger structure of how the economy is organized, they fail. And along in a similar note, if we have to have a more cogent and comprehensive narrative of the Israel-Palestine conflict, then I think the left-wing narrative has to be reinforced, even if the right-wing narrative might be more popular given the digital age and the larger right-wing age that we are living under.
Yeah, Jyotish, could I just add to that? I think it's also important to recognize that the far right, whether in the United States or in Europe or in India or in other places, for the most part, remains solidly pro-Israel, in many cases anti-Semitic and pro-Israel, but Israel is cultivating and promoting the far right for very good reason, because it's become the bastion of support, perhaps the last remaining bastion of solid and dependable support for Israel. And I think it's perhaps for that reason also that when you do get prominent right-wing figures who speak out against Israel, that they become so visible, because they're also somewhat of an anomaly from that milieu.
I also want to add to that this the opposition to Israeli crimes within the right is largely an American thing. I might be wrong about one or two countries, but most of the societies and politics that I follow, it is very, very marginal within the right. And part of the region is the naked history of American empire and its brutality across the world, that even sections of the right now opposes the war machine. If you look at India or other society within the far right camp, this kind of opposition to Israeli genocide and crimes and apartheid and occupation remains very, very marginal. I mean, I might be missing on one or two countries, but that's the larger picture.
Okay, I'm going to have to cut it short, but I'm listening closely to what both of you are saying. You're talking about the issue of race on the global level and saying I'm wrong about it, and you're raising the issue of Israel continues to cultivate the international far right, regardless of what might be happening in the U.S. domestic scene. And those are, in my opinion, important qualifications to what I initially put out there, and I'll have to take it into account. I just personally, as I said, I find it a troubling development. I don't know the extent to which the podcast universe is representative of the American population. So, you know, even 1 to 2 million against 370 million is a drop in the ocean. But I find it a troubling development where I have, so to speak, and I don't say this with any kind of chagrin, I say it with political concern, that I have been displaced by Tucker Carlson as the main defender of Gaza. I find that funny, I have to say. Because it's so ironic, but very unfunny given his politics and my belief that he has sufficient demagogic capacities that it's a worrisome development. I wouldn't say that with Candace Owens. I don't think she's a cut from the same cloth. I would say it with Nick Fuentes.
I think Fuentes is kind of a case that's very far removed from many of these others.
But when I hear, Nick is just trying to be transgressive.
Yeah, but I don't think, you know, these other individuals you've mentioned would be caught making similar statements, frankly.
No, they wouldn't, but that's probably because they're more diplomatic.
Well, I mean, we have to go by what they say and write.
I agree. And as I said, this is a subject for another time.
And with that, we arrive at the close of this week's episode. As always, stay curious, stay courageous, and keep asking the questions that unsettle power, challenge silence, and light the way toward justice. I'm Yara Rashid, your host and narrator. It has been a profound honor to share this space with you, a space where truth is spoken without compromise, where resistance is carried with reverence, and where solidarity is never up for negotiation. If you have reflections, questions, or if you feel called to step behind the mic as a future host, we welcome your voice. Reach us anytime at twippodcasts@gmail.com. To our listeners, thank you. Thank you for your time, for your trust, and for your willingness to walk this difficult path with us. And to the brilliant team whose vision and dedication keep this platform alive, Bob Funk, Stanley Robinson, Stephen Lowe, Sophia Rose Woolman, Tahani Abu Musa, Dr. Rana Awad, Dr. Bethany Marks, Abby Masri, Juliette Salameh Olivier, Reynad Al Ghul, and our editor, Muhammad Al Ghul. Your labor, your spirit, and your unwavering commitment are the heartbeat of this show. You remind us every week that storytelling is not merely a craft, it is resistance, it is care, it is collective memory. Until next time, keep walking toward truth, keep walking toward Palestine. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, proudly broadcasting from WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We'll return next week. Until then, take care. Stay steadfast. Free Palestine. Philistine Hurra.
ويل ويل عالظالم ويل ويل من الله لا سهر على نجوم الليل لا لا ويل